I'd like to call the Special Committee on Energy to order. It is Tuesday, February 21st, and it is 10:32. Members present are Vice Chair Sponholz, Representative Clayman, Representative Johnson, Representative Johnston, Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chair Wolt. Today we'll be hearing an overview from the Alaska Energy Authority, Michael Lamb, Interim Executive Director, and Katie Conway, Government Relations Manager. And we have some other people online from AEA, Sean Scaling, Chris Noonan, and Katie Lister. And if you guys could come forward and introduce yourselves and tell us what you do.
Nathan Glass is at my age.
Yeah, I know that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Lamb, and I am, as you said, the interim executive director for the Alaska Energy Authority, and I have Katie Conway with me, who is the government relations manager. And I'm hopeful that, and I know you mentioned a couple of people, but we actually have several key staff online to answer any questions in case they came up. Both for immediate gratification, it's just far more effective if you have something. If we can answer it, we'll try to do that. And so with that, I actually have hopefully Chris Noonan, who's our rural program manager, Katie Lister, who is our chief economist, Amy Adler, who is our AEA controller assistant CFO, Kirk Warm, who's our chief operating officer, Tom Erickson, chief procurement officer, and then, as you mentioned, Sean Scaling, who is the assistant executive director and also the policy director for AEA. So questions, they should be able to take care of them if we can't. It's hard in a short time frame to give a decent overview of AEA, but we're going to try to do that. And if you will, try to, and put the quotes around the try, to adequately balance covering the activities AEA does, and specifically the questions that the committee we were asked to address. So balance that against the time. So as best we can, we're going to try to do that and keep on track. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to just get started here. So the first thing, and I think you also received hopefully some handouts that have some text on it, so we didn't have to put everything on slides, but AEA's mission is to reduce energy in Alaska. But in order to go and cover some of the topics that we're going to talk about today, just there are some historic things that are sort of important to bring some perspective about where we are and what we're doing, and also the statutory guidance authority that we operate, where we obviously try to do the work that the legislature assigned to us. So 76, of course, AEA has been around for four decades, but in 1999, moving forward to that, the legislature basically reasserted AEA as the state's energy office, and there was a time then where they wanted a reuniting again of the energy programs that we're going to talk about and the owned assets. But also there's a huge renewed focus on funding of rural infrastructure. And then skip forward to 2007-2008, as we all remember, oil prices went exceedingly high, and so there was a renewed focus by the legislature for renewable energy development and actually energy planning. And then in order to accommodate that, there was a request to the ADA and AEA, the board, to do something, and the board actually changed its bylaws, changed the management structure, and essentially went from two agencies with a singular executive director to a couple of separate executive directors, with AEA focused strictly on the cost of energy, and then ADA, of course, focused on the jobs and economic development. And that's under the umbrella that, if you skip back to 1993, which is almost a quarter century ago, the legislature actually combined ADA and AEA and consolidated them. And so there's been a shared services since then that works intricately together to cover all of the stuff related to the financial system, the audited financial statements, the banking, the bonds, all of that stuff is done together. So those are the... Yes, sir.
So in 93, it was two separate directors. I mean, it was one director.
Yes.
And then in 07, it got split off into two directors?
Yeah, about in that, yeah.
Okay. but still shared services and...
Yeah, the AIDA and AEA staff have been together almost 25 years, longer than a lot of people have been married, and it's just the truth, and a lot has been worked out through the times, and both agencies, they're large agencies. You have market debt, you have banking relationships, I mean, all the stuff you have to do, and it's hugely complex, actually. So moving from history to... why do we do the things we do? Why are we going to be talking about the things that we're talking about? And you can actually look to the statutory guidance, 4483070. Besides talking about promoting and developing the economic welfare, it actually talks about that AEA is to provide a means to finance and operate projects, power projects and facilities, and recover waste heat. But a little further on in 4483, it says, and carry out the powers and duties assigned to it under 4245, which is very instructional, quite frankly, and is way more on point to the things that we're going to talk about today. And in 4245-900, which is assistance to rural utilities, the language says the authority shall provide the technical assistance to help with rural utilities, helping with catastrophic prevention. Needs to provide training programs for utility projects. It says shall provide technical assistance and training to utilities to improve their efficiency, their safety, and the reliability of those power systems and to prevent emergencies. And if you've had a chance to hear the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy, AKAES, it actually talks about safety, talks about the reliability, the dependability, and affordability of energy systems, exactly the same type of same language. The thing that gets to be instructive at the end of the 4245, and it says this, at a minimum, the assistance and training, i.e. the AEA is supposed to do, must include related to distribution systems, related to generators and being more fuel efficient, preventative maintenance, safety inspections. Here we have waste heat, metering, improved management administration, coordinating regional activities, i.e. get into planning, and the circuit rider maintenance program. And in doing all of that, those eight thou shalts must do, you need to give priority to contracting with the private industry, which of course makes a lot of sense, and to make sure that essentially state dollars also end up in private industry's hands. And when we get to the emergency operations piece, you'll actually have it has some really good numbers that speaks directly to that. So that is a little bit of the history that's relevant to the direction the legislature has given us through changing times related to energy costs, and then, by the way, go and do these things. With that, this slide three, when I first started working with AEA, it was kind of hard for me to get my hands around all of the stuff that AEA does. And so we basically kind of created a four-quadrant system to look at and use for discussion purposes today. And you'll see these quadrants in the upper left-hand corner, which one applies. But essentially, the top two quadrants are rural. So take all the rural, and then the bottom two quadrants are urban. And on the left-hand side, there are ongoing programs and services that AEA provides, basically directed as a result of those eight things we talked about. And then there's projects and infrastructure. And using really loose terms, the items on the left side are really somewhat operating budget items, if you will. The items on the right side really are capital budget-related type items, if you will. But there are examples where the lines get skewed there. And emergency operations, when I get to that, is a really good example of that. So that's kind of the framework that we're going to work with. This next slide, slide four, really is sort of the presentation order, and it covers hopefully the specific things that we were asked to cover for this committee, but basically rural, power cost, urban, and then the rail belt assets. So moving on to the programs and services for the rural communities, which are the two top. So this section is going to be that. And the rural programs and services are really listed here. The power cost equalization, utility training, that's one of the PCE programs, is one of our programs. This is where we actually, the clerks from the rural communities actually come to AEA's offices a couple times a year and do on-site training for those clerks so that they know how the PCA program works, et cetera, the requirements. The Utility Operator Training Program is a program that AEA manages, oversees, and works with ABTAC and Seward to take those individuals in the rural communities that actually operate the utility systems and give them hands-on technical training in Seward. The technical assistance is basically, and this is, sounds kind of goofy, but it's a good example, that Ghostbusters, who are you going to call when you got a problem, right? The technical assistance really is the phone call, the rural community that needs help, needs guidance, needs input. They pick up the phone and they call our technical assistance people. And there we actually get like thousands of phone calls. It is a lot. The circuit rider, cool name, and there was actually a question of what the circuit meant, not electrical, but it's kind of like in the old Western days when you had the circuit judge that actually went around and actually went to the location. And the circuit rider is where our staff, the technical staff, actually go on site and visit the locations so that when you go back to that list of eight items in 4245, do they need help with some distribution system or having a problem? Are they get a new generator that's online they're having? Are there safety? Just so that's where they actually go on. So on-site training, off-site training, answer the phone call, actually go and visit them. The electrical emergency response, we'll get into that. The power cost equalization program, we'll talk about that in some more detail. Katie, I've given Katie the harder stuff to deal with, so the power project fund loans, she's going to deal with those a little bit later. And then technical assistance, and then the energy policy lead. The AKAS is part of that, so the regional energy, and Katie's going to touch on that. So those are kind of high level, and speaking of the more difficult stuff, I just gave this one to Katie.
For the record, Katie Conway with AEA. I'll be super fast here. I will go over RPSU and bulk fuel programs or projects a little bit later after Michael covers the technical assistance and operator training, circuit rider and emergency response. These are two of AEA's flagship rural energy programs. The other things on the list are they operate in rural areas but also everywhere else in the state, so I'll cover those in the second half of the presentation, which is more on statewide or urban programs and projects.
Thanks, Katie. So, moving on, the first, and we tried to, hopefully it is beneficial to the committee, but try to display the programs and services in a consistent manner, which is through the use of maps and this first slide happens to be with the power cost equalization and the clerk training. And these, all of these maps that follow are actually by community. So in that 5-year fiscal period from 12 to 16, there were 37 communities that sent their employees to Anchorage to AEA's offices for the PCE training. And what's interesting, it's not just 37 clerks, it's actually more than that because of the fact that in the rural communities, it's not good or bad, but there is turnover that happens and constant retraining. And in fact, this next slide, which is the slide of the communities that the utility operators have come from the communities to Anchorage, work with AEA, go to ABTAC to do the on-site. So there's two dates here. One is there's 11 through 15, so that 5-year fiscal period, which is about 92 communities sent operators. So however many would be more operators than that, but 92 communities. We're 92, which is a little bit less than 20 on average per year. But if you look at 16, you'll see there were 34 communities sent operators. So if you actually annualize that and the fact that there is a recurring requirement and need through time with these operators, that 34 times from 11 to 15, you'd have 150. So it's just, and it's the same thing with the power cost equalization. It isn't like you train them and then you're done. These communities are perpetual. The running of the power plants, the need for reporting is perpetual. So this is an indicator that even though we've trained, there's a constant retraining that goes on as well.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Do you do any cross-training between these two programs? I'm just visualizing a small village that you've trained them technically.
do they get any time during that training sort of a sense of the PCE so that they can go back to the clerk or vice versa?
Through the chair, if I could restate, Representative Johnson, your question is, would the utility operator in Seward learn something and be trained to go back? And I don't know the answer to that, but I know that we actually put a lot of effort, and we actually have a rural outreach person to talk about PCE and what's needed. The operations themselves is what gets reported by the clerks. I cannot imagine in my wildest dreams that part of the discussion and the training and the funding that these communities need through the PCE is how the PCE program operates, the information that the clerks need to have from those operators in order for them to report back to the state to comply with the statutory requirements.
And I just, to me, it's just sort of the cross-fertilization of being able to ask the question when they get home. So I gather from your presentation that type of connectivity is done through the circuit rider.
I think, as a matter of fact, it's probably through the chair again. It happens a lot, almost in any of the programs, that whether they're talking to the technical assistants, whether the circuit rider's there, whether they're talking to the PCE staff themselves directly, whether they're talking to the project engineers. I mean, everybody in our shop is aware of the PCE program, the critical nature it is to these communities. And so there is no real siloing when somebody comes. We're only going to talk about X, and we're not going to talk about something else that is a benefit to them.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question. Is there a requirement that a community that receives PCE funding get PCE training? I mean, in other words, how many, you're required to train technical and PCE clerks, et cetera, but is there communities that take the assistance or take, a guidance on a power system, but then don't get trained on it properly? Or obviously, many more, I think anyone who's eligible for PCE funding, I would imagine, takes it, right?
I think it would be fair to say, and probably accurate to say, Chair, is that at some point in time, somebody in every community had gotten PCE training. The difficulty gets to be is when that somebody leaves and then getting the new person in and trained to get the information.
Okay.
Yes. Absolutely.
Chair Will, if I could just add a little bit more. Again, this is Katie Conley for the record. You also mentioned in your question operators being trained on new powerhouse systems. That is, in fact, a part of the RPSU program. At least in recent iterations of those projects, rural operators are brought in at several different points of time during the construction of the module and trained up in a less risky environment on how to use that system. And I hear it's very effective.
Okay. Thanks.
The chart of it gets to be is, I think everyone does what they can do whenever there's an opportunity to make sure that the communities have the training and know what they need. And if they don't, they know who to get hold of to get it. Right. So, and one of the things about this map, like the last one, is when you look across the state, and we put a little bit of the road system that's from the rail belt area, but there's hardly a part of the state that doesn't somehow use this particular program. A lot of rural communities do. This next slide is the technical assistance. This is the who you're going to call Ghostbuster scenario. That in that 5 fiscal years, there were 77 of the communities that used that service. And again, it isn't like 77 calls. They get calls all the time. And I may be a little bit, I try to be accurate, but when I had this conversation one time, it's like, well, we did it. We tracked the calls for a 3-month period, and it was near like some 1,000 calls. And it's just like the volume to keep track of it, don't keep track of it. I wish we did, which is why we don't list the calls. Almost all of these are just simply by community and a ton of phone calls. It is critically important. These rural communities that don't have a lot of maybe human capital they'd like to have, the financial capital they'd like to have somebody they can call that isn't going to charge them but is going to try to give them the answer they need. So moving on to the next program we have is the circuit rider, where, again, this is where you go back to those 8 items that I listed in the statement.
statute, the generation, the distribution, the waste heat, whatever it is. We actually go on site to the communities, and this is from 2011 through 2016. And then this particular map is with, doesn't have the communities on here, but this is a roll-up of those four programs we just talked about and how dispersed they are across the state. You can see the coverage and the relevance of the AEA programs and services. It hits and supports a lot of communities. So one of the areas we want to talk about, spend a little bit of time on, besides the ones that the committee asked about, was electrical emergencies. And this is driven by a couple of things. One, it's always an issue internally. What is going on with these rural utilities? It is an issue with the board. Whenever we respond and let the board know what's going on, and we've spent money on an emergency. And I think one of the, if you've seen the Alaska Affordable Energy, the very first slide, I think it is, has a, what do you call those things? The satellite view of Alaska at night with the lights on, right? And the question is, are the lights on, number one, and number two is, are we, as we're progressing over time and money is tighter and grant dollars go away, are the utilities, is there a trend where communities are going to start going black, right? Which essentially, in rural communities, you have to have the fuel, bulk fuel farm, you have to have the generation, you have to have the distribution. If you have that, hopefully it works, one of those components goes away, the lights go out, right? And one of the best metrics that we have to look at this and is the emergency response. And so we're spending a little bit more time on this one. And as you can see, and you know you all are able to read, and I was so bad, that the language is kind of important. It says the utility suffers an electrical emergency, the authority will, again there's another you shall type thing, subject to the availability of appropriations. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that because there's two pieces to that. Assist utility in responding to the emergency and recovering. Basically, we're back to generating and distribution, get it back online, right? And then the assistance can include financial assistance or technical, i.e. pick up the phone and call, including emergency repairs. And this section B really is sort of the critical thing, and it links back to the discussion about availability of appropriations. So first, identification, or the definition, if you will, of what is an electrical emergency. And it is essentially the imminent danger of life or the likelihood of significant disruption of electrical services, right? Mm-hmm. So under the availability of appropriations, there's really two ways the AEA has money for this program. Most of the time, and this is an example when we said, right, urban or rural and urban programs and projects and operating budget versus capital. So this program actually operates on an ongoing basis, just like the normal programs. You'd think it would be funded out of the operating budget, but in fact it's actually funded out of the project budget, which quite frankly makes sense. So there's a little skewing again here where the money goes across the line. But the interesting thing about this is that if it's AEA has the money and it was funded through project, then the lights don't actually have to go out for AEA to respond and assist. There's an imminent danger if the utility thinks that there's a problem, that they don't take care of it, the power's going to go out. AEA has the ability to respond. If AEA hasn't been funded, and there was one year in the last 3-4 years, I forget which year it was, where we actually did not get funded and the emergencies were funded through DMVA, so we had an emergency. You have to go through DMVA, who contacted through RSA, AEA to do it. But under that circumstance, there actually has to be a bonafide emergency. The lights actually have to be out for there to be an emergency. So part of where the funding comes from is the significant distinction of the lights maybe have to go out, and we know there's a problem, we get help, where are the lights out? So that's a kind of a significant point. So this slide was built actually by Chris Noonan and his staff when we were trying to explain to the board what kind of is the sequence of events that happens when there's an emergency. So, and it is especially directed towards the question of the funding and what happens in the future and how much on the hook is the state going to be if the lights start going out, right? And is there, if you will, is there a disincentive for utilities to not maintain their equipment in rural communities if they know the state's going to come in and fix it, right? Mm-hmm. So this is actually a great slide to talk about that and put it into perspective. So regular utility operation, things are humming along. All of a sudden there's power outage. Hopefully they're able to call us. Sometimes the batteries go dead, and that's by satellite phone. It's interesting when you read what goes on with these. But somehow they get hold of us. We help them diagnose the problem. Then, depending upon the nature of the problem, it could be either the utility's own staff, their personnel fix it. Sometimes AEA will send their technician or technicians out. Or, alternatively, we'll actually send a contractor. We have contractors that are on a list that we call all the time and work with to send out. It gets fixed, and then the imminent danger, as we just talked about, showed, is over. At that point, AEA's role, and essentially the financial, I think use the word responsibility, but it's a good word, the financial responsibility for the state to step in and help is inside of that box. So then after that, then it's the utility's responsibility after the emergency to do the repairs and take care of it. And so if the power goes out, yeah, we'll do the triage, whatever is necessary to get the power back on, but it is up to the utility to make sure that the utility is operating and do the major repairs. So there's no real incentive to let their equipment fail, because we'll do what we need to do on a stopgap basis to get it up, but then they need to actually take care of making sure the plant is operating the way it should be.
Excuse me, we have a question. Yep. Representative Johnson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So basically you're saying that the state liability is in that pink frame, and there's an exposure there, but once that pink frame has been completed, then the state has no exposure. It's back to the local utility. Is that correct?
Through the chair, absolutely correct, Representative Johnson.
And this is kind of a non-sequitur, but I remember, I think back in the 2000s, there was an Alaskan company that was developing a distant response for utilities. In other words, so you could manage your generation from afar. Are we doing a lot of that, or if you get to that point, you can answer that later.
Actually, I can give you a quick and dirty answer. Oh, through the chair, sorry. Quick and dirty answer to that is, we actually have at the warehouse where our technicians ride, they actually have ongoing monitoring of the utilities they want to have, where they can actually keep track of some of their stuff.
So we are embracing that and engaged in that technology.
To some extent, absolutely, the answer is yes, which is why a lot of them call us, or we're looking and watching, and we're constantly going back and forth. And in fact, it's not in here, but since it just popped into my head, when we first were talking about this, and this came from information from Chris Noonan, that it's like, well, before the circuit riders program started, there evidently, on average, right, was about one catastrophic failure per year of a generating facility. And now it's maybe one every 5 years. And part of it that you're talking about, the training, the phone calls, all of that stuff has hugely benefited all of the utilities in the state. So keep it going because of time.
I have a question. Calls. Two things. So one, you don't bill the community for this to fix their stuff.
No.
Okay. I didn't think so. And two, you just said something triggered another question. I can't remember what it was.
If you are the chair, we can always come back to it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. You just said something, but I guess about disincentives or incentives for a community to maintain their equipment. Obviously, if it breaks and you guys get it running again, then, oh, I know what it was. You said one catastrophic failure per year, per community, or
no, per,
overall?
Per year. So approximately,
for your whole,
there's about, depending on how what you put in the stack, right, of how many there are, there's around 244 generating facilities, entities, utilities in the state. And most of the problems, of course, are not in the rail belt and stuff. It's more in the rural. But historically, on average, when we ask Chris about it, it's like these guys, they're fairly adamant about the way things were versus the way things are. And that
failure would be like a complete burn down. I mean, like a power plant would burn down or something like that. So
out of 244, you have one failure per 5 years.
Approximately.
That's pretty minimal.
It's much better than what it
is. So the times you have to like run out there and deal with a catastrophe is pretty rare.
And in a couple of slides, I actually try to put some dollars around it. Okay. Again, because whenever, you know how this is, right? That we have to report stuff to the board. It's always the bad stuff. It's not the good stuff. And so the board constantly hears usually the bad news because, by the way, here's a problem. And so we try to put some framework around it, which another couple of slides will end up doing. And so I'll just keep moving here if that's good.
Yeah.
Thank you. So there's that. Then reason in the time that this came up was there was Art Village, and here's where an example of that. Yes, we stepped in, we assisted, got the power back on, and then Art Village through the Power Project Loan Fund actually got the money to do the more permanent repairs, which is what they're required to do after you get outside of, as Representative Johnson talked about, that red box. And then Diomede actually used CDQ monies. So here's a map.
CDQ is
Community Development Quota. So fish money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the acronyms might fly over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My and others' heads. I don't know. We don't live in this world all the time. CDQ. Okay.
Yes. This is from my St. Paul days. That's why I only know that. But so this is a map of a 10-year period of the emergency. So there were 72 emergencies, and color-coded it. Blue means that community utility had one needed emergency assistance one time in a decade. And the other end of the spectrum where you can see that there's one red and one orange, far more frequent, which is a problem. So all in all, you can see that for these rural, remote communities, yes, they need help, but all in all, it's not as bad as you would think, one. And secondly, the first analysis we did, which was 5 years, it actually has a slightly better trend than the 10-year. And so when I think about, for what I know from these metrics, think the light's going to go out and that the utilities aren't doing what they can do? I think, of course, they're doing what they can do, and stuff still happens, but it's not bad. This is, so for the board, and I want to do this as sort of perspective of, well, what is the exposure? What is the cost to the state, right? And this is over the 10-year period. Plus, this gets back to on that page we shared with you that has the statutory stuff. At the very bottom, that B, it says that, by the way, AEA, in doing all of these things, you're supposed to do those eight deals as much as possible, engage contractors to do that work. I get money into private industry, and that's how we come to it. So this is that slide. So on average, about $285,000 a year the state has paid. All the contract or the freight material supplies are all basically private industry payments, and really the state, the labor and the travel, probably half of that is airplane tickets. So probably 90%+ of the money that the state has used to help communities deal with their emergencies has gone back to the private industry through this process, and you can see that. But then to try to get some perspective of, well, $385,000, is always a lot of money, and it's a lot of money now. But to try to put it in context, to say, well, there's approximately about $1 billion worth of, once you get outside the rail belt, of infrastructure, right? Distribution system, generators, that you spend maybe $285,000 a year when something happens. And what is that? That's like 0.029%. But this is still is kind of like, how do you wrap your head around that? So I always like to, this is really bad, but this is the way it is. My wife, I always use for good examples. So, my wife has a $30,000 car, wintertime, gets a flat tire, doesn't want to change it, calls for roadside assistance to come help her fix her tire, right, change it, she's on her way. That $100 is like 0.003%. So that's like 10 times more on perspective. If she has a flat once a year or something and calls for help. And actually, even the better analogy, and the guys probably appreciate this more, not to be gender biased, but that's like having your car break down because a fuse went out. And you replace your $3 fuse and your car's up and running again, right? And for me, my daughters come over, I try to teach them to change oil in their car, but they come over, I still check their oil. And now with synthetic oil,
quart of oil is maybe $5 a pop, right? So my daughters come in, and I throw a quart of oil in once a year, even though they're responsible to take care of the car. That's actually more than this. So just to give some relationship to what are we talking about, the context, that's a good analogy. So,
sorry to interrupt. So 244 communities, can any of these, when you do your stats of how many failures and all that, of your $284,000, does that cover, would you say all the communities have some link to AEA through either assistance or training, or are they all somehow, are you in contact with all of them one way or the other?
I think a lot of the, when you talk about GVA,
what's that?
Right? GVA, yeah. Fairbanks, yeah. And MEA, and those, I mean, those guys are big enough, they have the resources, they don't call us. There was a time, and I forget, was, because I asked this that question, it's like, I think we helped maybe two gas, or one of them, they actually contacted,
yeah.
But they usually, the more rural belt.
I mean the rural, outside the rail belt,
we have contact with a lot. Now, AVAC is an example where they have,
48.
You know, but we still end up dealing with AVAC, but they're pretty self-sustained. So you sort of get outside of that. And so I think it would be wrong to say that we contact, or we're in contact all the time with all of them. The ones that don't need us, they just go about their business. But we're always there to talk with them if they need. So, are we good?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'd hate to be mad if I don't leave her time, right?
Yeah.
So actually, perfect, Katie.
I just noticed something. How do you spell completed?
Did we spell something wrong?
I guess in case you're doing this for somebody else.
C-O-M-P-E-L-E-T-E-D. Oh, there's two D's in there.
Completed.
I used to, at the bro, I used to pay the assembly members a buck for every mistake in our budget, but I'm not going to do that here, but we'll fix it. Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm getting over the Juno crud. Again, for the record, this is Katie Conway, and I will briefly touch on these two programs, which work, the bulk fuel upgrades and rural power system upgrades are project-oriented programs that work in tandem with the technical assistance and training that Michael's just gone over to essentially keep the lights on in rural Alaska. RPSU projects, or rural power system upgrade, I apologize for the acronym, generally increase the efficiency of generating electricity 10 to 20%, but it could be north of 30 or even higher percent. Both RPSU and bulk fuel upgrade programs communities under about 2,000 people are eligible for these, so they're programs that serve just rural communities. For RPSU projects that upgrade the generation, power generation and distribution systems are the kinds of things that you'll see done. Bulk fuel tank farm upgrades, something to keep in mind though is that rural Alaska is powered by liquid fuels, and these are small communities that are remote. Fuel probably has to be barged in or maybe flown in, and a few places maybe trucked in, but it's imperative to the communities to have a facility where they can buy in bulk and lower the per unit cost of those fuels for both power and for heat. In recent years, in light of the fiscal constraints put on all of us and the need to stretch dollars even further, one of the emphasis on the bulk fuel program has been more to repair existing facilities wherever possible instead of simply rebuilding. And if we go back aside one more time to the map, you can see that over about the last 10 years, there have been about 100 rural power system upgrade projects completed across the state and over 100 bulk fuel upgrade projects completed.
One of the things as far as oil tank farms and bulk fuel is can be contaminated with soil. Are you part of that picture?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, yes, part of the RPSU program, or sorry, the bulk fuel upgrade program does address contaminated soils and I believe remediation of whatever is being required.
Do you have a fiscal note as far as that impact?
No,
Chair. We do not have responsibility for the individual fuel pumps, which would then, of course, probably require fiscal note if there was a need for it. Rather, I think, and this goes back to my days at St. Paul and the bulk fuel farm that the city had, and, you know, created the diking and the double well tanks, and as the older fuel farms end up being rebuilt or whatever, then the higher standards are put into place. But it's no different than when we assist a community with a generator that had an emergency. We don't then all of a sudden take responsibility for that power plant. We simply help them. And so we're actually sort of the conduit usually for the federal dollars and stuff and to help bring them up the standards, but we don't take responsibility.
So through the chair, there's no state liability or exposure then?
I don't think that's the case. And let me, if I may, sure. Through the chair. So Chris, hopefully you're online because I said you were, but do you have an answer to that question, Representative Johnson's?
Yeah, basically, we work with DEC whenever a contaminated site is located in the community to make sure that it's identified. They're basically the responsible entity for taking care of any contaminated site. We basically will work in conjunction with them to do what we can to mitigate as much damage as we possibly can when building a new tank farm. But it's their responsibility to do any cleanups of the site.
I'm just thinking of that little pink.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Representative Johnson.
So that's the area the tank farm's built on, the land that's built on, it belongs to the city or the borough or the power company, or is there any standard?
Whomever it could be. When I was at St. Paul, it belonged to the city. That was a city fuel farm. I can't say across all the state who owns what, but
right.
Somebody owns it.
Follow up.
But not the state, generally.
If you use the word generally as a caveat, no, it is not the state.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I appreciate where Representative Johnson is going with that as far as, you know, cleanup and, you know, how state dollars are expended if it, you know, if there's some liability at all to the state, I guess. I think that's where...
Yeah, I was thinking that makes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
Actually, you know what? We're good with time. I actually got on Friday an email from Kirk, who's the chief operating officer. He forwarded it to me. It was after 1 o'clock, and I read it, and I thought, you know what? I should just bring it to this hearing, and if time permits, I'm going to read it. And so hopefully I'm not shorting us at the end. But this is actually an email from Franny Hughes from Fort Yukon to Kirk, and had to do with an EE visit. Actually, it was an RPSU visit, by the way. And it just says, thank you for your help in allowing Alan Kirsch to visit our site, as it has been tremendous help to have another set of eyes to look at our CHP plant here in Fort Yukon. CHP, and I had to ask, by the way, combined heat and power. So here again, if you go back to the 8, this waste heat and all that stuff, we did review the punch list with the contractor and our corporate concerns and feel much more confident to allow discussions toward finishing our project with the utmost care. It was great to review the bus system, the bus bar, with Alan yesterday, as our plant manager needs to have a good understanding of what to expect. It was also good to have Curtis here to discuss and review points in the change of our distribution system. Our confidence level in how our village will be served is much stronger. Alan says he will have his trip report upon his return to Anchorage office. I know it is good to assure remote villages where support is, and I'm thankful to your office. With kind regards, Granny Hughes. And I would chop up the corporate name, but for Yukon. And there's an example which I thought, why should the committee not hear this, that here you're talking about the heat, you're talking about distribution system, talking about generator, you're talking about the circuit rider, basically, where even though I thought circuit rider, but they go on site and assist. And so anyhow, hopefully you appreciated that. So, moving on. Power cost equalization was one of the items that asked us to talk about, so we have a few slides to talk about that at a real high level. And, of course, let us start with the map and the font size and the bullet size, a lot smaller here. As of February 193 communities are in the PCE program, which are displayed on this map. This particular slide, I think, is a great slide in that it shows and depicts what the PCE ends up being. That purple line, the base rate, is the average of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau's rate. That becomes the base rate that the PCE uses. And this chart, is, I think, as of 6/30/2016, so the end of that year. At that time, the rate was like 15.82 cents per kilowatt was the average. So what you see is there should be, and I think at that time there were 191, but basically 191 bars up and down. And so the orange, the top of the orange shows by community, of those, each of those communities, from lowest to highest, their cost per kilowatt to generate and distribute the electricity, right? So this is what the cost is, the ratepayer would pay. The blue, the darker blue, is after the power cost equalization payments are made, the effective net rate that they end up paying is brought down to the blue line. So all of the orange in those different communities is essentially what the power cost equalization pays to those kilowatts that are subject to PCE reimbursement. Mr. Chair.
Representative Clement.
Thank you. Just on this particular side, I just want to make sure I'm following you accurately. We often see price and time on the axes, but this is actually, this has nothing about time. This is just all the communities, the 193 communities are laid out on the graph. And the one on the far right is the most expensive, and the far left is the least expensive.
Absolutely.
What communities are those two? Just my curiosity.
I would say the one on the left, just so I could get it maybe barrel because of the financial system. We'll find out if it's true. So, Mr. Chair, if I may. So, Katie or Sean, can one of you answer that question, please?
Yes, for the record, this is Sean. Yeah, I'm with Rockford Energy. But the ones on the left are off North Loughborough because there's the flood. And on the far right, I'm sorry, I'm getting at the moment, but so on the far end, generally are very small communities with small loads. So very small loads and high cost to deliver the energy to those small communities.
I'll find out who it is.
Okay.
So that's your question.
More curiosity than. Whenever you see these yellow numbers,
I have a question, if I may. There's a couple communities that look. Are they not getting PCE because their blue line goes right up to the orange line? So they're basically paying the equivalent of no subsidy. Is that correct?
Correct. If they are under the base, and then all of the there is some formula that goes into it too. But if there's no. Yeah, they're not getting subsidy. Yeah, that's.
If they are, it's not helping.
Yeah, because we have one of them that one of the projects that we talked about before that actually has hydro and is a combination of different financing sources. That after they did it, they were just like, on one hand, they were troubled because they weren't getting PC anymore, but that's because the rate had been dropped down. It's like, better to have the lower rate, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to keep moving if that's all right.
Sure.
So this next slide, this is somewhat akin to the discussion about the emergencies and is there disincentive? Because there are some that go, well, if they get communities get PCE, they don't have an incentive to have the price as low as possible. This is a nice chart that actually shows that 29 of all of the kilowatts sold from a utility on an average are available to get PCE subsidy help, right? So that means there's 71% that don't. And the idea that you would not fight as hard as you could to get the lowest fuel cost, that you wouldn't have as much
gain as much efficiency as you could from your generators or whatever makes no sense when the rest of the ratepayers are paying a full charge. And of course, there's going to be pressure on the local level to make sure the rates are as low as possible. And then, plus, once you get past the 500 kilowatts per residential, and you get past the 70 kilowatts per resident that go towards community facilities, that's at the full rate too. So it's real obvious that 29% is not going to drive not caring about what the rate is, because everybody else is paying full board is going to care.
Thank you for the chair.
Sorry, I'm reading the charts.
Just so I make sure I understand this correctly, the community facilities, would that be schools or would that be community centers? What actually is a community facility?
Normally, I would think, for example, if they're state schools, it would not be, because otherwise it would be like the state paying itself. So that doesn't count.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, it depends on the use, and I'm going to defer to Sean and Katie on the phone for more clarification on that question.
Hi, this is Chair Scott again. The community facilities not eligible, the 2%, is actually community facilities that are typically eligible, but communities have exceeded its PCE allotment. Very few communities actually exceed PCE allotment for those community facilities. The schools and federal facilities and other state facilities are actually included in that 60% that are not eligible for the program at all.
Thank you.
I have a question. So if you're saying that 29 or roughly 30% is eligible for PCE, and if I look at this other graph on the previous page, that means that if orange is consumption, orange is rate, and then blue is the rate after the PCE kicks in, it shouldn't be reduced by more than 30%. Does that make sense? Looks like some of these are going down by half. Like the PCE kicks in, and the rate is half of what it was.
So first, though, through the chair, Representative Clement, Lime Village is actually the one that's on the right,
the most expensive.
Lime,
L-I-M-E, Village.
Where is Lime Village?
In Alaska. Sorry. Somewhere it's on one of the maps.
I did that.
You can Google it.
Sorry, Mayor. I thought we tried to answer the questions if we could while we were here.
I was going to say, but I will reach out that this is not dollars. This is the rate per kilowatt,
right,
which is a different, I think, slightly different. And this sounds really bad, but do you just restate your questions? Because probably Katie or Sean, one of those.
Yeah,
guys.
I mean,
do you mind?
Sure, and I guess you're saying that electric sales percent of kilowatt hours that are PCE eligible, so 30% of kilowatt hours are eligible, but the effect that what it does to your rate may be more than 30%. So if I'm paying, the nominal rate is say 50 cents, and then with PCE I'm paying 25 cents. So I mean, you're talking about incentives to, is PCE a disincentive to trying alternative energy? Because if half my bill is going down by half, because if I'm paying 50 cents, if the rate's 50 cents, and then with PCE it's 25 cents, that to me is a 50% reduction, maybe on my first 500 kilowatts, but.
Okay, so a couple of things. One is, just remember, this is the effective kilo rate. This has no representation of the dollars charged and collected.
Sure.
So you can't, don't use the blue and orange to be converted to dollars.
Sure.
It's purely what is the effective kilowatt rate.
Right.
Secondly is that the utility themselves don't really,
well, they may benefit from stability, but it is actually the residential customer that is benefiting from the net, right? It's not utility, because utility is going to charge whatever the rate is. The question is who is actually paying the number of kilowatts they use times that total rate, and it's just split between the individual homeowner and the state's hanging. But what's also true, and I don't have the statistics here, but I read them, and if you want to know, I can ask Sean, he probably knows. But the truth is that rural households use far less electricity than do urban, and a lot of them are actually less than the 500 kilowatts. And so,
when largely that's due that when they go over 500, the rate goes, so they're probably keeping an eye on it.
They're right. I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
Less money too.
If it's 80 cents a kilowatt, I'm gonna.
Okay. So,
I know you want to proceed that. You know, those of us that don't live in communities with PCE, which is probably everyone at this table, so we don't always understand it and internalize it to the effect that you guys do. And people bandy it around like, oh, and exactly how it works, you know, isn't always obvious to some of us.
I think the short of it is that the cost per kilowatt is whatever the cost per kilowatt is, right?
Right.
It's kind of like going out to, you know, the kids, right? It's like the bill is the bill. Now, are your adult children going to help you pay for it, or are you still expected to pay the whole bill? And as the kids get, at least my daughters that have gotten older, they help pay part of the bill.
Sure, sure.
And so so it's the same deal here. And generally, the residential assessment, they don't go, I'm going to haphazardly use electricity because the state's going to pay half of it, because once they hit that 500, they're paying the full rate anyhow. And so there's a huge incentive because of the cost. I mean, ultimately, when you get out in those communities and you see the cost, you're still way above the average, right? Even with that, and your numbers are pretty close, because on average it's like 45, and you get 24 cents, I think, and leaves you at 21. Well, the national average, from what I just was reading, is like 12 cents per kilowatt. So, and then the state is like 15.82, and I think it's 16.67 in 17. And so there's no incentive to go, the state's paying extra. I mean, and it certainly doesn't do the utility any good. It doesn't really matter. Their cost is their cost is their cost. So, which kind of leads me into this, the question that comes up is the PCE recipient. Are they penalized when you do the Renewable Energy Fund project or money that comes in? And the answer is really basically absolutely not. What ends up happening is that, let's just say there's $100 that's saved because an energy project was done, right? It's just less. So first of all, the 60%, when you went back to this slide right here, the gray and that, those people are going to end up with a lower bill anyhow, right? So let's just say your cost per kilowatt was $1 before you did the REF project. That's what it cost. You did the project, which includes the cost of the REF project, and now it's down to 90 cents. First of all of those people that didn't benefit from the PCE anyhow are getting 10 cents less per kilowatt, right? So they benefit. Then the second piece of this is, since all of the costs are lower, including that, you know, it'd be like the orange being up 10 cents higher, and then it's dropped, and then there's the equalization. So the state really benefits from the fact that you went from $1 to 90 cents, right? Mm-hmm. So they're paying less. And then because of the 95% formula, there's a little bit of a savings that subsidize the kilowatts that go through the PCE. So the short of it, when people ask about, well, aren't the communities being penalized when there's an REF project? Well, no, absolutely not. And this is why. Hopefully that makes sense. And if we're good, we're going to keep moving.
One more question.
Okay.
How is PCE is it calculated based on... per household, first 500 kilowatts. So if I'm paying, let's say, 80 cents, what percentage of that is covered by PCE funds?
So
how's that determined?
So the formula is that 95% of the utilities costs between, which is now the 16.67, that purple base rate, right?
Right.
So 95% of the utility costs between that and a dollar.
Okay.
If it's over a dollar, there's no benefit. So okay. Between 16.67 and 95% are used to calculate the PC level.
So the higher the energy cost, the higher the kilowatt rate, the more subsidy is going to kick in.
And, right, until you hit a dollar. So any of those communities that are over a dollar, like Lyme, for example.
Not many.
There's,
yeah. It's on flat and out at a dollar.
Yep.
Okay.
Does that help, Rick?
Yeah, it does. So it's not a flat fee discount. No. It's dependent on the price of the energy. Okay.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Katie, I think, so we put this one up. This is a map, you have it. This actually now takes the four programs we talked about earlier, adds emergency response to it, and adds the PCE communities, and you can see, again, the map starts getting filled out even more across the state where we have programs. So, Katie, I'll let you try.
Okay, and I am conscious of the time. I know we're moving toward noon, and so I will fly through this as fast as I can, and I just want to say that if I go through something very quickly, it's not because it's less important, it's just because of time.
We'll finish, but we'll do our best to not slow you down.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to cover what we would consider part of our statewide programs and projects, which includes urban areas and the rail belt. So programs and projects, including technical assistance that we provide throughout the state in our different energy technology areas, energy policy work such as the Affordable Energy Strategy, and work on programmatic type work on rail belt assets broadly and the intertie. Project development and finance assistance, which could be the future for a big part of what we do at AEA, given the state's budget situation, as well as planning and the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and the EETF. So first, the technical assistance. This is a different kind of technical assistance than what Michael talked about. I know that term is used kind of across the board in a lot of different areas. But what I'm talking about is managing working groups, statewide working groups for these five technologies that we would consider our core or critical technologies. I should say also that the five technologies, end use efficiency, hydro, biomass, wind, and heat recovery, this is what we would consider to be of most critical importance. And although BCG identified, I think, 17 or 18 technologies, they called it the long tail of energy technologies at AEA, we've been working since the summer in full recognition of the changes, the adaptations needed internally to kind of evolve with the changing fiscal climate, that we need to focus on these five. Drawing from the BCG report, the six what they called lighter touch technology areas. So these are things where you won't find a program manager at AEA, but you could still get some expertise you could still get help from an engineer or a project manager who has worked on these things in the past. And that includes energy storage, heat pumps, solar PV, transmission, solar thermal, and advanced grid. Under AEA's roof, we have kind of a unique situation where under one roof in one place, you have a lot of expertise necessary to take a truly whole community approach to finding appropriate and achievable energy solutions tailored to the specific needs and circumstances of any individual community in the state. Part of what we do in AEA's operating budget funds ongoing technical support in these areas. That includes program and project development, stakeholder engagement through technology working groups, grant writing for competitive federal dollars that increasingly plays a very strong role. And this is the support system for that project development and finance-oriented project future at AEA that I'll get to at the end of my slides here. A commonly heard kind of mantra at AEA among project and program managers is energy efficiency first. We all recognize that the dollars we spend investing on programs and projects throughout the state go farther if we're getting more bang for our buck through efficiency improvements. Over about the last 10 years, AEA has managed building efficiency improvements in nearly 150 communities, and those projects ranged from simple lighting upgrades to deeper building retrofits across multiple buildings, bringing up a wide range of both electric and heat savings to communities that pay some of the highest energy costs in the state.
Chair.
Yep. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Just so I'm clear on this, is AEA the project manager or just the technological assistant?
In this particular case, or you mean in general?
I guess it didn't matter. As far as what we're looking on this map.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Johnston. Both. Project manager, in each of those iterations of the Village Energy Efficiency Program was managed a little bit differently. But we've always been a strong project manager and have in-house expertise to help as well.
Okay, thank you.
Does that answer your question?
I have a question. So, back to this page with your five critical technology areas and six lighter touch. You said you had people already, a person for each of the five, a program manager?
That's correct. Biomass and heat recovery is the same person.
Okay, so four people. And then, but the other six?
We just have kind of an assortment of experience within the project managers on staff who have worked on these types of projects historically or managed grants that incorporated that technology.
And would it be fair to say that in the current climate, as you were alluding to, economic climate that is, that the six on the right may be more utilized now since, say, a big hydro project or a big wind project may be off the table at the moment because of the high dollar, whereas these other smaller technologies potentially are more utilized?
Mr. Chair, I would actually say the opposite. These five on the left, these five critical technologies, are more important, and the work that we can do simply through technical assistance and project development assistance and helping communities and utilities access appropriate, achievable financing solutions can bring these projects to bear. Whereas on the right, these are things that maybe are not as, these technologies are not as mature in Alaska, they're not as prevalent, and so they're not as relevant. They're still important, but the ones on the left are more important. So I'm going to go on to the next slide now. This map shows all projects funded to date through the Renewable Energy Fund, which has had eight funding iterations over nine rounds. This has led to 287 applications funded. And because applications can be for different stages of project development, including resource assessments, feasibility studies, design, and construction, that doesn't necessarily reflect 287 individual unique projects. That's just applications funded. And the next slide will show you the operational projects that have resulted from the Renewable Energy Fund investments over those eight funded rounds of projects. Additionally, there are 21 more projects that have secured funding through construction, and so we can anticipate another 21 projects coming online. And one more thing, just to kind of link back to what Michael was saying about PCE. We often hear questions about the relationship between PCE and renewables, and the REF in particular. There are some common misperceptions about how those two interact. And the simple answer is that PCE reimburses eligible expenses. So if your REF project was entirely grant-funded, then it's not a cost, but it doesn't hurt PCE, and it's still a benefit to the community. They are synergistic, not oppositional.
Excuse me, Chair.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
I'm curious as far as the, it looks like there's two geothermal projects, and you don't need to answer me on those now, but I'm curious what they are. Unless you can.
We might be able to, through the chair. Can I call on Sean or Katie to answer that question for Representative Johnston? Or someone else in Anchorage?
Yeah, this is Sean Scalin with ABA. So find movement in that as well, looking for city officials and trying to call their board. There are none that are operational that have been funded through the Renewable Energy Fund. Perhaps is it the heat recovery projects that are being looked at? I guess I'll leave it at that and answer it further if needed.
Okay, thank you. I saw one to the east of Homer and one in Juneau. So I was, anyways. And you can send me an email. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer that. Yes, that's a ground-source heat pump in Philadelphia, and there's another one probably yes in Juneau. I see there's another one. Those are all ground-source heat pumps. That's
okay.
Traditional
high-temperature
GSO.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Steinholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm trying to just understand this slide a little bit better, slide 31 that we're looking at right now. So there's 70 projects that are operational. Is that an additional 21 projects that are funded through construction? So they're funded, but they're not yet operational?
That is correct, and that doesn't necessarily mean that all funding in order to get to construction comes from the REF. A lot of these projects have supplemental funding.
Okay, so in theory, we'll get to the point where there's 91 projects that will be operational once these 21 are done?
In theory, yes, okay. Barring the unexpected.
Thanks.
The relation of PCE and renewable energy keeps coming up, but as was, say, for example, the one in Fort Yukon, which was combination heat power. PCE is only going to help out for the electrical portion. I have a utility bill that supplying heat, and I guess this is distributed heat. I don't know. In these particular plants, are they producing heat that gets distributed, just like power gets distributed, right?
Again, Mr. Chair, I would have to defer to the folks in Anchorage who might have actually at their fingertips a little bit more information about the projects, if that's okay.
Well, yeah, sure, that's fine. But like the one, the letter you read, was it CHP, combination heat and power, or something like that? So I assume they're both transmitted to consumers.
Yes, and that would be a heat recovery project, probably.
I guess I'm trying to, the relationship between electricity and heat,
right,
is the PCE is subsidizing the electrical portion.
Correct.
But yet a utility that's producing both and selling both, I just don't know if that, you know, if there's a, if that comes into play. Is that one subsidized and one isn't? But they're both being produced by the same fuel, let's say.
I don't think so, and I would have to imagine that if they're, a piece of equipment was used that provides both benefits. Certainly the part that, or the piece of the price of that equipment that relates to electricity would be fit into the cost per kilowatt hour and then paid for with PCE. The benefit of the heat ought to be just that there is less heat cost that benefits. So you have a project that partially was paid for with electrical, but there's a side benefit through the lower heat cost, right? Yeah, they were.
Go ahead. Keep going. Sorry, I just thought of that.
Would you like us to?
No.
Okay. All right. I'm going to keep going then, and back on slide 32. So the Renewable Energy Fund hasn't had money for the last year, and that has brought questions up. But I would argue that this program has served a very important function and will continue to serve an important role in the energy landscape in Alaska. For starters, the $257 million that's been invested has jump-started the renewable energy market in Alaska, proving that these projects do work and giving us good case studies of where and how and why and when. The REF has leveraged hundreds of millions of federal and private dollars and displaces a tremendous amount of diesel every year. Last year, about 31 million gallons, which equated to roughly $63 million saved in 2016. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, a lot of...
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a question I kind of been curious about, and you may have no way of answering this right off, but obviously renewable energy are depending on where some, you know, wherever, what village or city is located at, They have different types of availability, I mean, whether it's wind or tidal or so on. I mean, I guess I was wondering how many towns, has there been an evaluation of towns based to identify which ones could actually have something besides diesel? I mean, obviously Barrow has its own source of power. They don't, and something like that.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the Alaska Affordable Energy Model is a reconnaissance level planning tool that incorporates data sets from a lot of other sources mm-hmm. that can kind of get at what you're talking about.
And I think too, maybe even though if we don't get to them at the end of this stack, there are slides that show potential hydro potential, wind mm-hmm. potential, which I think was partially getting mm-hmm. there. There's mm-hmm. a lot of opportunity mm-hmm. across the state mm-hmm. for renewable energy mm-hmm. projects in the future.
Is there funding for it? I guess that's the question.
It depends on what you consider funding. I would say yes. Funding can mean financing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not free money,
necessarily. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, obviously it's the critical importance that the small villages have some kind of opportunity to get away from diesel if they can, so to get away from the volatility of power, because it's just such a, I mean, it's so critical to do that if possible.
Okay. One thing about the Renewable Energy Fund projects that I think is kind of interesting and also frequently a source of friction is the perspectives, the differing perspectives in how we do the economic analysis, which is required for the ROF program. We have to do an economic analysis of each of the projects, that's each of the applications. And depending on what costs and benefits you take into consideration in that analysis, you might end up with a different result. The state takes a universal approach, so we count all costs and all benefits regardless of who pays and who benefits. But at the local community level or from a project developer's perspective, they're probably not going to include everything. So not all of the value of the grant funds, or maybe the cost, the reduction of PCE payments as a benefit. And if you look at this chart in the blue, you see the state's perspective. This is a hypothetical project here, benefit cost ratio of about 8. So that's it's a low benefit cost ratio. But from the community perspective on the same hypothetical project, it's 1.4, which isn't bad. I have some specific examples from ROF projects. The Seward Sea Life Center seawater heat pump, which has been written up a ton in the media, it's a very successful ROF project. The state's perspective, so the full cost of the project was $250,000 and the BC ratio was 1.13, so still pretty solid. From the community perspective, with a $225,000 grant from the state, the BC ratio grows to 3.77, so it was even better. Either way, on this one, no matter which way you sliced it, it was still a decent BC ratio, and that's probably part of what led it to be funded. A more extreme example is the Chickaroon Solar and Biomass Project. The state's perspective, taking into consideration $153,000 of total cost, gave it a BC ratio of 0.74. The grant ask was $127,000. So from the perspective of the community, considering that grant funding, the BC ratio went up to 4.46. This one was not funded in the end. It was recommended, but it didn't score high, and it's just scored very low on the list.
So the state takes the community, or
universal
chart we looked at here,
mm-hmm.
which BC benefit cost ratio would the state evaluate it on?
The blue.
Okay. So they don't look at the differences, the reduced fuel, that the lowers the PCE payment. The community doesn't look at that because they don't pay it.
Exactly. And so you end up with a differing perspective that sometimes can cause some disagreements about what should and should not be funded with state dollars.
So it's about the state benefits more than the community in this case.
No, community. Money's involved, and this is one of the reasons for friction.
Right. Well, it says total benefit is 100 for the state and 70 for the community.
From the state's perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry. Will you give me a 1 minute warning, please, when you are getting near to the cutoff point? So,
we'll get 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
get a 10-minute warning.
So moving on to this this next slide, this shows the energy planning regions across the state. Regional energy planning is a way for Alaskans to determine their energy priorities and formulate a concrete, implementable, fundable energy plan. As of last summer, plans were complete for every region in the state addressing energy needed for electricity and heat as well as transportation. These plans are all located on AE's website if you really want to geek out into the details. And they served an important input in the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy, which was also completed in 2016, as you know. Regional energy plans were primarily a bottom-up, regional-led, and community-vetted planning initiative that relied on extensive stakeholder engagement to produce a list of projects that would hopefully lower energy costs. Categories of recommended actions generally included utility management and operations, building efficiency, electricity, heating, transportation, and also ongoing planning. The Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy, as you know, is a set of recommended policy, regulatory, and statutory changes that would make it more possible to reach those energy project goals outlined in the regional energy planning process. We've been asked to clarify the relationship between the Affordable Energy Strategy and regional energy plans. It's a strong relationship. A critical piece of the Affordable Energy Strategy was the Stakeholder Engagement Foundation, and that was built primarily on the Regional Energy Planning Initiative and the stakeholder engagement process that was so central to that. Policy and planning work go hand in hand. This is a really good example of that. Regional energy plans provided the basis for policy research, which was the AKAES, the recommendations in that report. And the chart you see on this slide shows the interplay between community and regional planning, statewide planning and policy development, and project implementation. As recommended by the Affordable Energy Strategy, the system relies on strong data collection and continuous stakeholder engagement, as well as effective project funding mechanisms, which don't necessarily include or don't necessarily mean exclusively grant funding. Another interesting example, and I just wanted to bring this up because I think it's really cool. I actually just found out about it. This is an example of how planning and policy work comes together through multi-agency coordination and leveraging of resources to address issues in communities. AEA has recently started working with a group of other federal, state, regional, and local partners to investigate the feasibility of developing something they're calling a power pool. It's a regional entity that would provide management and operational support to small single-site electric utilities in rural interior Alaska. And so we've been working on this with Tanana Chiefs, the university, Department of Energy's Office of Indian Energy, as well as local utilities. And this is this initiative is a direct outcome of the regional energy planning process that is also supported by recommendations in the Affordable Energy Strategy. So one of the other questions we received was about energy policy work at AEA and how that's done. I would say that a pretty broad group of staff contribute to energy policy work, from the executive team to project managers like those who led the Regional Energy Planning and Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy initiatives. Policy work is largely dictated by legislative mandates like the Affordable Energy Strategy and SB 138, but we also get asked to weigh in or help coordinate policy initiatives by other bodies like the Governor's Office from time to time. I'm wondering if I should go through these. We were asked to do a targeted review of four of the recommendations in the Affordable Energy Strategy, and these are a little bit lengthy. So the four we were asked about were the one-stop shop, or the Community Energy Fund for Alaska, on-bill financing, siting authority at the RCA, and establishing a universal service charge.
Well, in the interest of time, and I know that on-bill financing is going to come up from another individual, I believe, who's going to introduce a bill about it. So why don't we skip that part?
Okay.
Maybe the first and the last for now, then see if you have any time. The one-stop shop and the universal service charge.
Okay.
We got about 4 minutes. Is that going to work?
Okay.
We'll make it work. And the affordable energy strategy is still fresh enough in everyone's memories. I don't mean to do a summary of what the project was or why we did it. Okay. So, the affordable energy strategy research found that many communities and utilities are in a position to take on more debt, but they need more flexibility with funding opportunities in order to better address their needs, as well as assistance in accessing those opportunities. That's what the CIFA would get at. It would be a one-stop shop that would, an organization that could maybe go out and get funding and take it in and then re-lend it or re-grant it, whatever, whether it was a grant or a loan, abiding by the unique parameters of the specific funding received, and then also providing technical assistance so that communities and utilities with low capacity because of their size or scale would be able to more effectively tap into those resources. And financing is probably a big part of that, financing, debt financing projects in the future as we see more constricted public funds for grants. And then the second one you wanted me to get at was?
On bill financing. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Universal.
I'm sorry. Skip on bill. Yeah.
Universal service charge.
Yes, someone's paying attention. Universal service charge.
The statute that created the Affordable Energy Strategy, as you know, also required us to come up with ways to pay for projects, which is the hard part because nobody ever wants to pay for it. Universal service charge or systems benefit charge, these are both common practices in the utility industry in the rest of the country. They provide a way to secure reliable funding streams that don't rely on government appropriations to address industry-specific issues. The recommendation in our report did not specify where the dollars collected would go, only how they would be collected, and the types of programs and projects they could help support. In many parts of the country, largely as a result of regulatory mandates, the utilities themselves are responsible for the administration of energy programs and projects that are designed to lower costs for their consumers. So that's why universal service charge was included. And probably the most important thing to remember here is that no part of our report made recommendations for any utility or community outside of the Roy Belt. So the recommendation to establish a universal service charge is strictly for utilities within the study area, which does not include the Roy Belt.
And just to spell it out in layman's terms, the universal service charge is?
It would be a small percentage collected per kilowatt hour or per gallon, 1 cent or a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour, perhaps. We didn't recommend specific mechanics. We just say this is a concept that could work if applied within the study area. It could generate revenue that would pay for projects and programs.
And that would be spread across
wherever.
Right, but it would probably work best if it's...
Again, I would say that would have to be a part of the public and deliberative process in determining what is the best way to implement this concept. It's a policy concept that we know works. We've seen it in a lot of other places.
Well, in other places, how is it just spread across the board and then the funds collected are also used for projects that benefit everyone that's paying in?
Yes, but I don't know if it's an apples-to-apples comparison because in other places you have much larger utilities serving a much larger area.
Right. So it hasn't necessarily been done in this kind of environment?
Not as I am aware.
Okay.
No,
I'm just asking.
Okay, I know we are getting really, really short on time. We're done.
If you have a wrap-up.
I do have, I'm going to just jump to the
statement.
To the last slide. Can I do that?
A lot of interest because you're asking a lot of questions. So.
So there are resource maps in here that show what the potential is for energy efficiency, hydro, biomass, and wind in terms of project development work that could be done here. Mm-hmm. And if you have questions, we would be happy to address those later. But this map, the last slide, shows how relevant AEA is. There is hardly a community or a utility in the state that is not touched in some way by an AEA program or project. These efforts are comprehensively improving energy safety, stability, reliability, and affordability, and the benefits are shared across rural and urban Alaska, utilities and consumers alike. And even despite the restricted public
funding in the state. There's a lot of growth potential. The resources are abundant, and there are opportunities to find financing through the federal government and the private sector.
All set. Well, thank you both very much for coming in, and thank you for all those on the phone. And obviously, there's a lot of interest, a lot of questions, and
we'll be happy to come back.
Okay, thank you. I'll adjourn this meeting at 12:02.